are listening to a presentation of the book Changing Places, written by and read by Myra Yarborough DeBruel. This is Bob Martin for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience and is being produced in cooperation with the North Carolina Library for the Blind and Physically Handicapped. This begins Disc 4.
Chapter 24, Summer. It had been a while since the snowballs in my hands had melted into long summer days. After my first eye surgery, Daddy had bought me a beautiful blue girl's bicycle. Years before, I had learned to ride Larry's bicycle around the two trees in Mama's front yard. Now I had my own bike. Riding it was my most favorite thing to do. I rode around the yard, Mama's house, through driveways, anywhere I could ride without going into the street. On this day it was too hot to ride, I parked the bike in Mama's backyard against the umbrella tree and sat down on the steps to her back porch to think. I wonder if Mama and Daddy realized I was going up to Fisher Cottage in the fall, and if they even remembered the names of my house mothers through the years. After Mrs. Johnson, there had been Mrs. Oates, Mrs. Fine, and Miss Eubank. Mrs. Fine was a rather large lady, and her voice was quieter than Mrs. Johnson's or Miss Davis's. She had red hair and gave a new meaning to a red-headed person with a temper to match. Lots of the girls did not like her one bit, but some of them had not had the training to deal with house mothers like Mrs. Johnson. So she didn't seem all that bad to me. Mrs. Eubanks was a very tall, happy lady, perfect to rule over young teens with hormones changing into different moods daily. Now in the fall, there would be yet another house mother to get used to. After the surgery, as the day stretched into endless sunshine, I stayed with Mama while Mama and Daddy worked. Mama worked at an overall factory uptown, and Daddy managed the Western Auto Store. He also raised some cattle, farm cows, a few horses, chickens, and pigs. He raised feeds for the animals and hay for the horses and cows. Most days, Larry was busy plowing the pastures or hoeing or whatever there was that needed to be done. There was not much to do at Mama's, so I found myself wandering around the barnyard. Mama had told me when I was little that if you pick up a chicken and put its head under its wing, it would go to sleep. I snatched a little white chicken and carried it over to the wooden steps on Mama's back porch and sat down. The chicken didn't peck me at all, but fluttered its wings, letting me know it had rather be somewhere else. I tucked its hand underneath his flapping wing and held it there and rocked it back and forth, singing to it. Sure enough, soon the chicken stopped moving, and I didn't know if it had gone to sleep or stopped breathing. I felt underneath the chicken's neck. The feathers were thin and soft under there, short little things with ruffled edges like a pleated skirt. I rubbed the feathers as Larry walked up. Larry was going on 15, and suddenly he seemed to be mad at everybody. As if that was not bad enough, he seemed to think that he was my boss and that he knew everything. "Stop torturing the chicken," he said. "I'm not torturing them," I said. "Well, how would you feel if somebody held you somewhere you didn't want to be?" Larry asked. I thought about that just for a split second and wanted to hit him. Didn't he realize I had been held somewhere I did not want to be for years? But the thought caught somewhere in my throat, and instead I said, "Well, how would you feel if somebody shot you in the leg with a BB gun?" "I think you're getting a sassy mouth on you," Larry said. "Is that what they're teaching you in Raleigh?" "Who died and made you my boss?" "I'm your boss as long as Mama and Daddy are not here," Larry said. "I don't need a boss, and if I do, it's Mama," I said, as I threw the chicken in his direction. The hen fluttered into consciousness and landed gently on the grass. "Go put it with the others," Larry said. "Do it yourself if you're so worried about it," I said. "Maybe you'll tell Papa not to chop off its head for Sunday dinner." "Oh, who cares? It's just a chicken," Larry said as he stomped up the steps past me and into the house to get a glass of lemonade or tea. I decided to go sit on Mama's front porch swing. It was a comfortable place, maybe the most comfortable place I had ever known. I walked around the yard, passing the hedge that grew along the edge of that side and the rose bushes that grew up against the house. I passed the bushes in the front yard and moved the cushions on the swing to a comfortable position. The swing was blue and hung on one end of the porch that ran across the entire front of the house. All around the edges of the porch were flowers and pots and crocks and even tin cans. Besides the swing, there was a white porch glider and two chairs that matched. I made myself comfortable on the cushions on the swing. I got the swing started and then curled up both legs to think. Green vines hung low over the roof, making a lacy curtain shade. This summer, I spent lots of time writing braille letters to Laverne in North Wilkesboro, Anne in Richlands, Shelby Jean in Kannapolis, and even Billy in Charlotte. I thought how funny it had turned out that now, instead of writing to Mama and Daddy, I was writing people in other places. As I was thinking, I heard the back door of the house open and voices inside. I jumped up and ran for the swing and went in. My cousin Darrell and his mother were in the kitchen with Mama. Darrell and Aunt Becky lived just across the wooden gully bridge through a small patch of trees, and usually I spent as much time at their house as I did at Mama's. Darrell and I were buddies, and often I would take his hand and walk with him to the gardens. I told him names of plants, and together we named the cows, the chickens, and the cats. "Why don't you take Darrell out on the swing with you?" Becky asked. "He's tired, and I bet you could get him to sleep." I took Darrell's little 4-year-old hands, and we sat down on the swing. Darrell's baby voice started trying to follow my newly trained soprano. I decided Darrell didn't care one bit about the songs Miss Davis had taught me in voice, and he was too young to know any of the rock and roll songs, so I sang, "Jesus loves me, this I know." "How do you know?" Darrell asked. "Well, listen to the second line," I said. "It goes, for the Bible tells me so." "Can the Bible talk?" Darrell interrupted me. "Well, no, but the Bible has lots of words in it, and when you get old enough to read them, you will understand that the Bible says so," I told him, hoping the subject was over. "Did Jesus make the Bible?" Darrell wanted to know. "Well, it's the same as if he made it," I answered, wondering how to get away from this subject. "Jesus made everything," I finally said. "Did he make you?" "He used Mama and Daddy to make me," I said as I grabbed him and started tickling him, hoping to get the subject changed. "Did he make your eyes funny like that?" he asked. "Do you think my eyes are funny?" I asked. "I think you have the best eyes in the whole big world. I think everybody's eyes should look like yours." I wondered if somebody had been talking to Darrell, maybe his mom or someone in the family. I thought about Laverne and began to understand a little bit why she often talked about getting artificial eyes. I didn't want artificial eyes, even though now I had one. I wished it made my eyes look better, or that it didn't matter to anybody else like it didn't matter to Darrell. I started singing, "Row, row, row your boat," as the swing squeaked its accompaniment. A dirt dauber sang a high-pitched note as it dug into the wood in the porch ceiling, and Darrell rested his head in my lap. "Are you my girlfriend?" he asked with a sigh as he fell into a nap. "Yes, and you're my little pumpkin," I said, as Darrell relaxed and breathed in the summer's day. As I stroked his little head, I found his hair silkier than the chicken's feathers. I twirled it around my fingers just as I heard Larry coming around the corner of the house. "Don't you think you're too little to be calling him your little pumpkin?" he asked. "No, I don't, Larry. He's just a baby, and you're a baby too," Larry said. I'm only 16 months younger than you, I said, and I am plenty old enough to babysit. I wanted to tell Larry how lonely it was for me in the summertime and how much I missed our spending time together, but didn't know how to say it. Maybe if he were 4 years old, it would be easier. That night at the supper table, Larry said to Mama and Daddy, I think Susie is spending way too much time at Becky's. She even calls Darryl her little pumpkin, and she acts like he's her own little boy. Daddy forked a pork chop and laid it on his plate in the middle of the corn, potatoes, tomatoes, butter beans, and biscuit. Everything but the biscuit had been grown on the little farm. I had tried to help Papaw milk the cow. I never could get the rhythm to milking right, and I believed it was probably because I was afraid that cow would forget I was there and just step right on top of me. Daddy took a swallow of milk, set his glass down, and said, Maybe you shouldn't go up there so much, Punk. You probably do get in Becky's way sometimes, and she has a lot of work to do. I was not up there. Becky and Darryl were at Mamaw's, and Becky asked me if I could see if I could get Darryl to go to sleep. She says I help her by playing with Darryl and she can get her work done. I don't bother her. She wouldn't tell you if you did, Daddy said. I ain't bothering her, I said. Well, just don't go up there too much, Daddy said, picking up another biscuit. Suddenly I forgot about being afraid of the cow or even of Daddy. I didn't stop to think before I threw my fork at Larry. He ducked and grabbed my wrist and started twisting it. Why don't you just go back to school, he said. I think you like it better there anyway. The words rang loud in my ears and tried to slide down my throat, almost choking me. Oh, you just want everything your way. What difference should it make to you what I do? Neither of us seemed to realize that Daddy had stood up, taken the fly swat from the top of the refrigerator, and walked over to the table. Suddenly, the woven wires landed on Larry's shirtless back. I cringed and tried to speak, but the words, the fear, and the truth froze the words in me. I wanted to shout that I was sorry, but I didn't know if I was or not yet. Daddy laid the weapon back down on top of the refrigerator, sat down in his chair, and started finishing his supper. Mama had already jumped up from the table and ran into the bedroom to cry. Larry didn't cry. He just picked up his shirt, put it on, and said, There's Johnny. We're going uptown. He walked out the back door. I helped Mama with the dishes, nobody speaking about those undigested words. I often had wondered what it was like when I was not there. Did everybody get along better? Was I a constant source of trouble when I was at home, like I seemed to be sometimes at school? I decided to write Laverne and tell her about what Darryl had said, but I wouldn't write about this supper. After the kitchen was cleaned up, I went into my small room to write letters before bedtime. I thought about school and couldn't understand the excitement. Oh, my goodness, was Larry right? There wasn't much for me to do. And after the surgery, I couldn't do much anyway. I was asleep when Larry came home. Early the next morning, we all sat around the breakfast table together, nobody speaking. Finally, Daddy said to Larry, Why don't you take today off? It might rain anyway, and that hay can wait until next week. He handed him some money and told him he could drive the car to the store if he would be really careful. The store was just a little over a mile away, and we knew that the store owner knew Larry, and we also knew he would not tell anyone. Daddy had already bought Larry a car, even though it would be a little over a year before he would be able to drive it legally. After Mama and Daddy were gone, Larry said, Do you want to go riding with me? Let me brush my hair first, I said. It'll just get blowed all over everywhere. I'm going to put the top down if I can. We didn't go to the store at first. We just went in the opposite direction down the road. My hair did blow everywhere, and the wind was loud in my ears. But Larry turned up the music louder than the wind, and my spirits flew like a hurricane. We went to the store, and he put the top back up and started talking to me about his new girlfriend, how he and Johnny Spry had tasted beer one time, and how he thought I would be able to teach him how to dance before I had the surgery and had to be too careful. "Want to help me wash the car?" he said. He pulled the radio out on the back porch, turned the music up loud, and he washed the Chevy while I turned the radio from station to station looking for Elvis Presley's voice. It was everywhere. As the summer moved along, I finally realized how we had grown apart during those long years when I was at school. We had turned into teenagers in separate towns and looked at the world differently now. We didn't know how to connect our two worlds anymore, not the ones we were leaving and the ones that we were heading into. I was a part of a place he could not understand, and he seemed so grown up while I was such a little girl inside. When I was not there, which was 10 months out of the year, he was an only child. Then he had to move over and let me back in again and again and again. Yet he never seemed to mind at all. When I came home sometimes, it must seem to him like the world stopped just because I was there. Mama made me clothes all the time, and my aunts and cousins treated me like a celebrity. Even he did sometimes. Now there was a distance trying to come between us, and neither of us seemed to be able to keep it from happening. Part 2, Chapter 25, Hello, Fisher. "Is Daddy going to bale hay forever?" I asked Mama. "He told you he was going to be late today," she answered. "Are you in a hurry?" I was in a hurry, but I did not want to tell Mama. Still, I could not keep the lilt out of my voice as I babbled all day long about nonsensical things. I talked about who I might room with. I talked about Billy and Miss Davis and Laverne and Ann. I talked about how to fix my hair and what I was going to wear to school tomorrow. I packed and unpacked my suitcase as I looked again and again at the dresses Mama had made and the ones she had bought. I talked about where I might go to church this year and about the mink coats at Pullen Memorial Baptist Church. I wondered out loud who would be my teacher and if I would like Fisher Cottage and the house mother. Mama listened to me chattering. Somehow she probably realized I could not wait to get back to school. She probably wondered when it had happened. In earlier years, I would have been thrilled to go back to Raleigh late in the day. Many times I had begged Daddy to take me back early Monday mornings after the long weekends, but Daddy never gave in to it. Mama had worked frantically to make sure name tags were in all my dresses and sweaters and that the indelible ink had not smeared in my slips and underwear. Mama ironed the skirts and dresses and folded them, only for me to unfold them and hold them up and talk about them one more time. Mama Bessie, Becky and Daryl, my Aunt Elsie and Cousin Jeff, my Aunt Marie and my Cousin Mitzi had all been down to tell me goodbye. Larry was working with Daddy in the hayfield, and Mama was listening as I danced around the floors and giggled at nothing special. Finally, Daddy came in. "How about if we wait until in the morning to drive back to Raleigh?" he said to me. I stopped mid-sentence and stared at him. "But I won't know who my roommates are," I said. "You know I'm going up to Fisher this year." Daddy looked at my face and read all the words I was afraid to say. He was happy that I had learned to love school, but I know he felt it was so good to have me riding around the place on my bicycle, listening to music and just being with them all. He really did want to take until morning to make the trip. Just as though I had said the word please out loud, he heard me say it in his spirit. He began getting ready. Finally, we were off. "Want to stop at the monkey store?" Daddy asked me. "Yes," I said. No matter how late it was, I enjoyed going around the side of the store and looking at the two monkeys in large cages. Daddy bought me an apple and sliced off 2 slices so I could feed them. It always surprised me when they reached out their little gray hands and took the food, eating it just the same way I did. If I made noises with my voice, they would seem to try to copy it, and if I danced a few steps, they would do that also. Then when I would walk back to the car, they would make loud whining noises. I wanted to touch them, but the storekeeper said they really were not tame. The store manager said Mr. and Mrs. Hastings came by about 30 minutes ago, Daddy told me. He also said they had car trouble and might have to stay in a hotel tonight. Shelby Jean Hastings was still one of my best friends. She lived in Kannapolis, and often her parents would bring her to Lexington so she could ride with me. Sometimes Laverne's mother would bring her to Lexington also, as she lived in North Wilkesboro. I thought about Shelby Jean and how thrilled she would be if her parents had to stay in a hotel another day. But we were just about back to school. Daddy pulled up in front of the building. There were no other cars close by at that time. The sidewalk was right outside the car door, not like the hill with the bricks Mama had walked up those years when I lived in K. I felt the usual knot of nausea inside me, but it was nausea of excitement, not fear. We entered the big double doors and went around to the stairs. Finally, we were upstairs and opened the door leading into the hall filled with high voices of teenagers everywhere. Most of my friends were already back. I took it upon myself to hug as many of my friends as I possibly could, as fast as I could. Squeals and laughter and words poured out between all 25 of us. "Who do I room with?" I wanted to know, and tried not to show my disappointment when I found out Ann and I were not rooming together this year. However, I was so excited about being back at school, I hardly noticed Mama and Daddy until they tapped me on the shoulder to say they were leaving. I walked downstairs with them and watched them get ready to drive off into the setting sunshine toward Highway 64. The sun was nothing but a little dot in the clouds as Daddy started the car. Daddy looked over and saw tears in Mama's eyes. "Well, had you rather her be screaming and crying when we left?" he asked. "I don't know," Mama said. As a child, I knew I would have been crying now. When did the tears stop? I didn't even know and didn't stop to think about it. I just turned around and ran as fast as I could up the three flights of stairs to my new room so I could get settled in. I roomed with Sandra Atkins, Stella Hall, and Jean Hastings. However, this did not bother me, as Stella showed me that there was a roof outside of the windows in room 3, which went past the windows in room 4, where Ann and Laverne were. "I go out there lots of times," she said, "and you can just sneak into the window of room 4 from there." In Fisher, the girls didn't have to go next door to eat, but could smell food wafting up the vents or the laundry chute. The chute went from the second floor down into a large clothes hamper in the basement. The door opening was large enough for any person to climb in. It was not many days before Janice got really good at sliding down the laundry chute and landing in the big hamper. Stella got good at it, too, and tried to get me to try it, but I never got up the nerve. Mrs. Strawn did not know what to do with loud music-loving, boy-crazy teenage girls. She really was too old for the job. Still, she tried to give guidance into our hard heads as we seemed to bump heads at every hour of the day. Every day, she would go check our rooms, and if there was a sock or anything we had left on the floor or on the top of our dresser or on the bed, we would not be able to go to the store that day. If it just happened to be something we honestly did not see, it made no difference. The school store had long ago been moved from the gym to a real room with tables and benches at the edge of Simpson Cottage, which was between K Cottage and the school building. It had been named the Knickknack. We could go there every day for 15 minutes and sit at a table with our boyfriend. The rule was that we had to sit at least 6 inches apart, and one of our teachers, who served as a chaperone, brought a ruler to measure if she thought that distance was any closer than that. Mrs. Strawn seemed to invent ways to keep us from going to the store. She also made a rule that if two girls were caught sitting on one bed, talking or playing cards or for any reason, they would not be allowed to go to the store that day. On Sunday morning, as we carried our plates up to the kitchen to be washed, she would walk behind us, feeling of our legs to be sure that we were not trying to sneak off to church wearing no hose. We all had to work very hard to stay a step ahead of Mrs. Strong. In spite of all that, I loved being in Fisher Cottage. It seemed to all of us that both Sally and Ann seemed to see even better than ever. One of them would always read the music magazines or true stories to us as long as we could get them to. Ann liked a boy named Donald Cook, and Sally had another boyfriend named Larry King. I wanted a boyfriend, too, and Billy was my first choice. Everybody already called us sweethearts anyway. Chapter 26, First Love. Billy and I took voice lessons together again this year, twice a week. On Thursday, we went into the large room. Miss Davis' room was very large, with rows of chairs for the choir, large bookcases filled with song books and music, recording machines, records, and record players. The room was painted white, and aside from the green color of the tile on the floor and the Braille song books, it seemed there was hardly any color in it at all. The walls were so white, I wanted to color on them. Billy stood silent, looking at the Braille music with the song we were supposed to learn. The paper was thicker than ordinary typing paper and was a pretty yellow color. We stood there at the baby grand and felt the summer awkwardness slipping away. There were five windows in the large room, and three of them were around two sides of the big piano. Fall leaves were blowing toward the screens of the open windows, red, green, yellow, orange, and brown. I knew Billy's birthday was coming up soon, so I started the conversation. "What do you want for your birthday this year?" I asked him. Billy's voice was shaky, the way I remembered it when we first started taking voice lessons in first grade. How about a Perry Como sweater?" he said. "A blue one?" I asked. "Oh, I don't know," he said. "I think I'm going to forget all about this birthday. Mama would probably forget it, too." His voice sounded far away, and I could not figure out if he did not want to talk to me or if he was trying to tell me something. The girls did not get to know a lot about the families of the boys we went to school with, but we knew their moods, and we knew we would take care of each other. I wanted him to kiss me, and wondered if he wanted to. Finally, I could not wait any longer. I put my hand on top of his, a little timid, but a lot determined. He took my hand, held it to his lips, and kissed it softly, then placed it on his face. I reached up to him, touching the little boy's stubble growing there. I reached up to his thick, blonde hair and felt a few wet tears on his cheeks. "Have you ever kissed a girl?" I asked. "Just you in third grade," he said. "Well, why don't we try it? And then if we get another girlfriend or boyfriend, we will know how," I said. His arms went around me, with one hand ran through what was now long blonde hair. At first, we tried the kiss, mouths closed and wondering what was wrong. Then he put his hand on the back of my head, drawing me close, and we shared a sweet kiss from the souls we had been sharing music from for years. We held on to each other tight, fearful that if we ever let go of what we had found, we would be lonely for it forever. "I don't want another girlfriend," he said. "Me neither," I said, as we stood there kissing as though we couldn't stop. We heard footsteps coming from down the hallway and quickly let go and turned back to the music on the piano as we tried to wipe the expressions off our faces. "What do you two want to sing today?" Miss Davis asked. "How Do I Love Thee?" we said together as we touched the title of the song with our fingers. Chapter 27, Between the Sheets. "Let's short sheet Janice's bed," Ann said. "Not me," I said. "Not me," Laverne said. "Not me," Hazel said. "Fine," Ann said. "Then I'll do it by myself," and she did, like the little red hen. Janice was studying late down the hall with somebody. I had climbed out onto the roof from the windows of room 3 and into the window of room number 4 where Laverne was. She was a sophomore this year. We finally giggled ourselves to sleep as usual, forgetting all about Janice's bed. We didn't forget long. Janice came in the room through the hall door like a normal girl, put her books down, and sighed a long, "I'm so tired I can't see straight," sigh. Then, as though she remembered she could not see anything, crooked or straight, she laughed out loud at something inside her head as she began turning down the covers, ready to fall into bed before the thought left. Then she realized the sheets would not come down, and the little laugh she started with turned into words. "It was Myra and Laverne," Hazel heard her say to mind Laverne's sleeping selves. Janice forgot she was tired and walked over to our bed, placing a very stern, swift pop across each of our bottoms. We still wonder how she knew exactly where those bottoms were, with no sight, but she did. Laverne reached over and touched my mouth to see if I was smiling. I was. But Janice was on her way over to Hazel's bed. Whack! Went the pop, as Janice talked under her breath about how she was tired of us playing tricks on her. Then she went to Anne's bed and said out loud, "I know she didn't have anything to do with it. I won't hit her." Did either of us help her make her bed? No. We figured we'd let Anne do it. But Anne slept peacefully on, so we let Janice do it all by herself, like the little red hen. Chapter 28. Happy Trails. Then the day came. Anne came in my room and sat down on the bed as I was reading Gone with the Wind. "This is better than a true story," I told her. "I have another true story to tell you," she said. I closed my book because she took my hand in both of hers. I knew something had happened. "What?" I asked. "Well, I am going to leave this school and go to public school. My eyes have improved so much, I can see 20/20.
"Really?"
"Really," she answered. "Mama is coming to pick me up Friday. Would you like to come home with me this Friday?" Tears filled my eyes. I was supposed to be happy for her. We had been best friends since kindergarten. All I could think of was what would happen to me without her. Now we would never sing together again or learn how to grow up. How could this be? Anne and I planned to graduate together. We were a pair, two little blonde-haired ponytail girls growing as teenagers together. Roy Rogers and Dale Evans and all our days together were gone without a warning. I couldn't breathe for a minute, and all I could see was Anne's pretty face shrinking, shrinking, shrinking into that place where all my sadness lived, shrinking until I could no longer see it or hear her voice. Friday came much too quickly. I had helped Anne pack her clothes. She cried over leaving Donald, and she cried over leaving me. But something in her was stronger than her tears. That something was the chance to see, to live in a world where she would be free to grow up with others like herself. I wanted to give her something for all the years she had loved me and looked after my tender heart. She was a strong one, not me. Yet she stayed quietly in the background while I sang and played the piano and violin. She always took my part, even when I was wrong. There was not anything I could give her for all that except to love her. I could hardly watch her walk down the stairs that Friday. I could hardly help her carry her suitcase. Of course, Mama and Daddy did not understand and would not let me spend the weekend with her. Anne's mother hugged me tight and thanked me for being Anne's friend. "You girls will keep the mailman busy," she said. Anne and I stood there for a long moment, both my hands in both hers. Then we locked in a tight embrace we knew would have to last us maybe forever. As quickly as she had walked into my life that first time at Kay Cottage, she was gone. I held tissue in my hands. I tried our trick of pinching our fingers until they hurt more than the tears, but I could not pinch them hard enough. Tears flooded my eyes until I could hardly see the sunshine. I just stood there for a long time and then began to sing, "Happy trails to you." Slowly, I began to release my fingers from the tissue as I tried to release my best friend from my heart. Every night after supper, I sat on the front porch in the rocking chair. No matter how cold it was getting outside, Gone with the Wind entertained me, but Anne had left an emptiness inside me I was not sure would ever heal. One night I sat there long after dark, rocking in the chair, trying to read, although my fingers were just too cold to decipher the Braille letters. Someone opened the door of Fisher Cottage, walked out onto the porch, and sat down in the chair beside me. Anne had done that so many times that somewhere in my mind I hoped it was her. It was Della Rae Campbell, a little girl in stature and a quiet girl, but with a heart like gold. "Would you like me to teach you to jump two ropes?" she asked me. "I can already jump two ropes at the same time," I said. "I can teach you three," she said. And we started talking about what we liked to do. It took a while, but soon I learned that it is hard to cry while you are singing, jumping three ropes, and learning to skate backwards. Chapter 29, Stakes. There was a silent, lonely song again inside me, playing quietly through the school days and nights. But I had Billy to talk to, my sweet Billy who would not leave me. We sang beautiful songs together now, high and sweet and heavenly. We stole kisses whenever we could, and he wrote me sweet Braille letters about how much he loved me and was sorry about Anne. Then Miss Davis was planning another trip to Kershaw, her hometown. This time I didn't have to wonder if I was going. Carolyn was going, of course, along with Joanne Parnell. We sang in a trio together, with Carolyn singing soprano, me alto, and Joanne contralto. Billy and I were singing two duets, and this time I was going to sing a solo. I loved going to Kershaw. Miss Davis acted like we were just ordinary kids, not blind children at all. She let us decide what we wanted to do. She left us alone on Friday nights to play games or listen to the rock music she hated. On Saturday morning, we walked downtown and decided to go to the movie in the afternoon. I don't really know how it happened. I was sitting on the end of the road with Billy next to me and Carolyn next to him. Joanne was beside Carolyn. Without meaning to, I had fallen asleep during the movie. When I woke up, I noticed Billy was leaning over, talking to Carolyn. "Why didn't you wake me up?" I asked him. Billy didn't answer me, but continued talking with Carolyn. I decided he must be explaining the scenes of the movie to her. However, when we left the theater and walked home, I also noticed how he kept glancing backward every time she spoke, and how he kept looking at her long after her question had been answered. I wondered what was going on. That night, we all sang songs for Miss Davis' family, many songs, and sometimes they sang with us. Billy and I sang several duets, and again, I noticed how he didn't touch my shoulder like he usually did before we sang. How could this be? On Sunday, we sang in church, had a wonderful dinner, and then got back in the car to ride back to Raleigh. All the way to Kershaw, all of us had laughed together and talked and sang. Now, Billy and Carolyn seemed to be having their own conversation going. Finally, when Miss Davis parked the car in front of the building, Billy leaned over toward Carolyn, and I heard a quick kiss as he was getting out of the car. I felt the blood drain from my face and wondered what in the world had just happened. My young heart had no idea of what this was. I ran upstairs into my room where love's first rejection slammed into my soul like a moving brick wall. How could this happen? How could I make the pain stop? I stood up and opened my top drawer where I had put the blue bow off the friendship ring that Billy had given me. As I sat back down crying, I unraveled the bow. It tangled around my toes like my heart was unraveling inside me. What was this anyway? I was just 13, too young for it to be love, wasn't I? I couldn't stand to think about Billy, and yet couldn't stop. With the heart only a teenager knows, I hoped I would just disappear, yet be able to see how sad Billy would be if I were gone. It seemed as if the clock would never move from that afternoon. I cried for Billy, for the friend I had lost in Carolyn, and for Anne. It just seemed like my world had changed before I could catch up with it. That night, I decided somehow I would not let Billy or Carolyn know how they had hurt me. Surely I could get another boyfriend. The next day, I found myself flirting with a boy named Jerry Watson, who did not waste any time giving me a sweet kiss. My heart felt sick as I thought about Billy's kisses. It wasn't the same. I tried kissing Jay's spell, yet nothing happened inside my heart. One of those 6 weekends, Larry Kendrick and I rode on the bus together. He was going to Edenton, North Carolina, and me to Lexington. I was hoping that surely he could help me forget about Billy, but again realized that no other boy was going to mend my broken heart. Was I actually in love with Billy? Months dragged by. Even Christmas seemed to have lost some of its glitter. After Christmas, I really tried to begin working on the process of putting high school things in front of my thoughts and Billy back into the music where we had met. However, I realized that there was no way I could do this until I confronted Carolyn. One morning I walked into her room. I watched her putting on her lipstick as she looked into the mirror at her angel face and smiled her angel smile. "He was my boyfriend," I said to Carolyn. "You are a sophomore in high school. Why did you feel like you had to have my boyfriend?" "Well, if he was your boyfriend, he certainly didn't act like it," she answered as she blotted her lip and put both her hands on her hips while she stared into my pitiful-looking face. "You really shouldn't think you're just so pretty and so smart. Maybe Billy got tired of hearing about just how pretty and smart you really are. I really wish you would stop trying to be like me all the time." "I've not wanted to be like you for a long time," I said. "But you haven't even noticed. I have loved you, and I have always taken your part against anybody who ever said anything against you. I won't do it anymore." I knew she did not care about one thing I have said. Probably she had never even noticed how much I had supported her and befriended her to those girls who were jealous of her talent and her beauty. I looked back as she turned and walked over to pick up her books for school. Her skirt had small pleats around the waist, and she wore a striped blouse with the green stripes the color of the skirt. Her hair flipped up perfectly in back. As much as I wanted to, I could not hate her, but only felt inadequate and humiliated in my young years and my young heart. Billy tried to talk to me every day in school, but I never answered. "Are you not going to speak to me ever again?" he said. "That is my plan," I told him. I wrote Anne and told her about my sadness, but Anne was not a part of it now. She had her own adjustments to make with public school and new friends. Days went by and more days. My grades began to drop, and one day Mrs. Purser, my science teacher, sent me to talk to Mr. Stowell, the principal. After he yelled at me for sassy Miss Purser, he made me go sit in the outer office and read for an hour. While I sat there, he got up and left to attend to other school duties. I was paying little attention to the English I was studying when Carolyn came in to use the typewriter in that office. Her sweater was red, and I felt a terrible pang of jealousy when I looked at her gorgeous face and her brown hair shining as though it had a life of its own. "Why are you here?" she asked. "Why do you care?" I asked. I was surprised when she left the typewriter and came and sat down on the bench beside me. Then I realized she was trying to take my hands in hers. "Oh, please listen," she said in a timid voice I had never heard before. "What in this world has happened to us? You know, it is really hard to grow up in this place. You see, I have problems, too. Billy and I have never been anything but friends at all, and hardly even that. That little kiss on the cheek was me kissing him for being so nice to me. He blames me because you won't speak to him. You don't even know about the life I live. We all try to learn to live together here, and then we go home, and it's still harder. Balancing school and home is not easy. Half the time, if my parents aren't really happy with me, people here in Raleigh are. It's like being on a seesaw sometimes. Anyway, I am really sorry. You and Billy have something special. I never meant to hurt you that morning, but I was just tired of my own situation. I really am sorry. I was not able to speak. I wondered if that was the truth. Had I jumped to the wrong conclusion? Were we just honestly seeing each other's hearts for the very first time? We tried to talk to each other, and both ended up crying. Finally, we hugged each other and walked out of Mr. Stow's office together, knowing that in spite of everything, we were friends. Still, her words and the day to follow could not erase my broken heart. Why had she not told me this before? I remembered how Billy wouldn't talk to me over the rest of the weekend, and how the closeness we felt when we sang together was so different. The days still grew colder and more confusing to me. By the end of January, I felt like I'd finally understood what sad songs were all about. To add to my sadness, Sally also left for public school right after Christmas break. Sally cried when she left. She cried for her friends and for her boyfriends, but mostly she was just too excited to think about anything but seeing. Sally had always tried to look after me a little, showing me new ways to fix my hair and how to put on my lipstick. It seemed like more and more girls were transferring to public school now. Anne, Sally, a girl named Iva Lee, Dorothy, and Faye had all gone. There were no girls left who could read magazines to us, but we were beginning to live those true stories for ourselves. Still, I missed all those girls that I had known since I was in K Cottage. I added them to things to cry about. Then Valentine's Day came. All my friends giggled and talked about the valentines they got from their boyfriends. I got some valentines, too, but nothing from Billy. Nothing at all. I didn't expect any valentines anyway, but I opened the package that came in the mail. Every year since I had been at school, Mom has sent me a box of valentine candy, which I either shared with my roommates or took to school and shared with the class. Mom finally got it right, I said to my new friend Jackie. All pieces with nuts in them. My roommates and I ate on the candy for days. Saturday night, there was a dance for the boys and girls at the gym. It lasted all of 2 hours, 7 p.m. until 9 p.m. Still, it was becoming a very important part of our week. Since my heart was not in it, Laverne had to talk me into coming with her. About 10 minutes into the dance, Billy came to dance with me. "Did you get the valentine I sent you?" he asked. "I can't get something that you never sent," I answered. For a few seconds, we were quiet, but quiet was not working, so I blurted out, "So, what are you doing dancing with me? Did Carolyn go home for the weekend or something?" "Carolyn is 4 years older than me. I don't love her. I love you," he said. "Why? You know I talk like I'm from the mountains and dress like I'm from the country. That blue sweater you have on tonight would make you beautiful anywhere you were," he said, like the real cool guy that he was. "You still didn't send me a valentine," I whined, like the spoiled, temperamental child I was. "Yes, I did," he said. "I mail them, chocolates, like you love, all with nuts in them. Didn't you get it?" It was the first year Mama had not sent me any candy, and the first year a boy really did. My heart began to mend a little as Billy tried to kiss my tears away. Somehow, it surprised both of us when we found out that it didn't work. Why was nothing the same anymore? What in my world was happening? Was it pain of first love? Oh, I love Billy, all right. No mistaking it. Just somehow, couldn't trust him not to hurt me anymore. I looked at him as though I was looking through the bubblegum he had smushed all over my face in fifth grade. Would we find ourselves back together ever again? I didn't know. He didn't know. But always thought we would. Somehow, as we approached our high school years, someone had gotten it through our heads that we could do absolutely anything we set our minds to. Somehow, all the way through high school, we believed it. Chapter 30, Turning a Corner. I was now 14 in the 8th grade. I looked in the mirror at my teenage face and didn't like it much. Ponytails seemed to be out of style now, and wearing my hair down made the glasses I was wearing look larger than life. They were brown frames, horn rims, and just plain ugly. They even had bifocals on them like older people wear. One day, when I was at school, I took them off and slid them inside the open space in the desk. Nothing seemed to change in my vision. Everybody looked the same to me, and I wondered what good those glasses were anyway. Just then, Donald Cook asked me a question, and I turned around to face him at the desk just in back of mine. "Hey," he said, "you look right good without those glasses." When I went back to the building, I looked at myself in the mirror once more. I thought about Anne, who had gotten glasses that helped her see 20/20, and before I knew what had happened, Sally also could leave for public school seeing 20/20 with her new glasses. Still, I knew this was not going to happen for me. I put the glasses in my drawer and realized I would never wear them again. Now, after getting hurt with my first love, I decided not to go with the nicest boy in school or even in America. This time, I would go with someone entirely different. I wondered what Anne had found so fascinating when she was going with Donald. James Dean did not have one thing on Donald Cook. If someone said yes, Donald said no. He walked to the tune of a different drummer before anybody sang about a different drummer, and I decided I would walk beside him. It all started when I was determined to be Donald's girlfriend, or at least I thought I did, but Donald was not sure. He and Pat Starnes, one of my pretty roommates, decided to put me to the test. Donald pretended to be going with Pat after flirting with me and dancing with me every dance on Saturday night. I was perplexed when on Monday, Pat announced that she and Donald were a couple. I had just lost Billy. Now I realized how little I knew about this boyfriend-girlfriend game. I wanted just to let it go. But then to make matters worse, every day, Donald handed me a Braille letter to deliver to Pat. Since the rules were so tough, every night a boy or girl would write their boyfriend or girlfriend a Braille letter to be delivered to them the next day by a classmate. In these days, that seems like such a strange way to communicate. But in the 1950s at the little out-of-the-way school, it was grand. Only now, I was carrying letters every day at lunch from Donald to Pat. It did not take but a day or so before this began to be ridiculous to me, especially since I realized he could just as well give those letters to Pat from any other girls to deliver besides me. So, on the second day, I read the last page of Donald's letter to Pat. I was shocked to find out that my intuition was totally right, that they were not going together at all. But Donald had used Pat to find out how I would react. He was only pretending to be her boyfriend. There were very few fights in Fisher Cottage. In fact, I don't think there were any fights in Fisher Cottage at all, except for the one that took place when I confronted Pat. I mean, she and I were roommates, and I felt betrayed by my friend. Why could Donald not just have asked me if I liked him? Of course, it never occurred to me that I should not have read the letter, nor did it occur to me to be mad at Donald, only Pat. I thought about this when we were pulling hair and pinching and scratching. Here we were, two girls physically fighting over a rebel boy. I think we both must have realized this about the same time, and I ran out of the room while neither one of us was really hurt, only our feelings. Donald was mad at me for reading the letter, and I was mad at him for trying to trick me. I was not sure I wanted to be his girlfriend anymore. I seemed to be doing just fine now without needing a boyfriend, since all they seemed to do was cause more trouble for me. Twice a month, on Wednesday nights, the girls and boys ate in the same dining room. The next Wednesday night supper was coming close. Billy was dating Judy Hall then, and Larry Kendrick was dating Marie Morgan. Laverne was eating with Belvia Maynard and Sherry, and I didn't want to eat with Carolyn or Pat, Joanne, or any of the senior girls. So, when the night came, I just walked in the dining room first and picked out a table where nobody else was. Girls dressed up in spring dresses, which brought their own ambiance to the otherwise dull white room and brown tables. I noticed Carolyn wore a skirt with large flowers and a purple blouse to match the small violets. I didn't think I was angry at her anymore at all. when I changed tables when I saw her coming my way. Jody Bolton was a girl from Greensboro, North Carolina, and came and stood at the chair next to me. I began talking to Jody. I liked her. Jody had albinism, and I thought her white hair was so pretty. She saw really good and often read my mail from Mama to me now that Ann and Sally were gone. I was so busy talking to Jody that it was time for someone to say the blessing before I looked over to my right and saw Donald on my right side. I thought perhaps Pat was coming to eat with him, but Larry McCreary, one of our classmates, was on his other side. Pat Howard and Ralph Thompson sat across from Jody and me, and Jackie and Allie Luck sat at Jody's left side. Mrs. Strom, the house mother, didn't like seeing four girls in a row when this was supposed to be a social evening, so she came over and had Jody change places with Donald. I thought this was a little bit funny, as still there were five girls and three boys. Donald and I seemed to be having a conversation by ourselves as though no one else was there, just like the one Carolyn and Billy had had in Miss Davis's car that Sunday. "All's fair in love and war," Donald said. "So is this war or love?" I asked. Little did I know what was about to happen to my already scarred teenage heart.
You are listening to a presentation of the book Changing Places, written by and read by Myra Yarborough-DeBruel. This is Bob Martin for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience and is being produced in cooperation with the North Carolina Library for the Blind and Physically Handicapped. This ends Disc 4.